This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. You've probably heard of U.S. society described in terms of different themes or ethics before. There was the frontier ethic, the notion that Americans were destined to keep moving to open frontiers and succeed through guts, gumption, and hard work. Closely related, the independence ethic, the idea that Americans don't cotton well to excess rules and limitation. But how about the utopia ethic? Today's guests know a lot about that one, harking back to a time when most Americans assumed technology would lead us to a perfect world. If that seems a bit quaint, don't go away. Technology scholars Catherine Barreto and Hannah Rogers may just be able to persuade you some of that utopia ethic could still be at play today, especially when it comes to encouraging more responsible use of technology. And if you've got ideas on that, you'll be welcome to join the conversation too, right after the news. Great to be with you. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. From nuclear power to plastic bags, how has a past century of new technologies improved our lives? When have they brought us unintended consequences that you'd say could be called anything but improvement? We have two technology scholars with us who have much insight to offer, not only on the present day, but how we might reshape thinking about future technology to encourage more solution and less problem in the years ahead. But we want to hear your perspective, too. If you've got thoughts on anything from the spork to smartphones, please do call us at 888-WMRA-TALK. If you could go back 100 years in time, what present-day technology would you most miss? If you could take that modern invention back in time with you, are there ways you can predict it would be creating negative consequences on a previous society? So many ways we're going to stretch our minds this hour with your help at 888-967-2825. Already on the phone line with us, a faculty member in the University of Virginia's Department of Science, Technology, and Society. I think she's actually in Florida this week, spending her vacation time helping a friend do research in mangrove swamps. But Dr. Hannah Rogers, thank you for coming back to civilization long enough to be with us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
Here in the Insight Studio, another member of UVA's Department of Science, Technology, and Society. She's actually the creator of a college course on utopias and the technology society, Catherine Barreto. Thank you for making time for us.
Glad to be here.
Well, Catherine, let's start with you. Would you tell us about the utopia ethic, the idea that many Americans once had that technology would indeed lead us to a kind of utopian world?
Well, first of all, I think we have to look at what is utopia, and with a lowercase u, because utopia just means something which is ideal, something which is going to make our lives better. And we've all, since time immemorial, we've all had this urge to, if we could only shake things up and make something better. And this desire comes from the potential that all humans have, that if we could only tweak this or tweak that, we could, for example, get rid of misuse of power or greed or unequal distribution of resources, and that we would all have a good life.
I mean, people actually thought that there were gadgets that would, as a result of creating them, we would be a more egalitarian society?
Yes, and we still do. And it's not just gadgets. It's how we use our tools, how we make our lives easier, whether it was learning how to make a fire and then move the fire from point A to point B. That's a technology.
Hannah, I want to ask for your thoughts about this, but we're already starting to get some phone calls, I'm pleased to see. And so I'm going to make room at least for our first caller. Anybody listening who wants to join in, again, it's easy to remember. Our number is 888-WMRA-TALK. But we're going first to Quicksburg. And Kathy, one of the producers, sent me a note here that you're probably going to talk about one of the things I always think about when I think about time travel going into the past. Give it to us.
Toilet paper.
Yes. So that is, are you like me? That's what you would miss most?
Yes. I work on computers for a living. But no, if I can't have proper toilets, I went to England in the 70s, and I was like, oh, my God, I got to go home.
Wax paper?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I was there at about the same time, had the same experience.
Right. We wrote home on
but
that paper.
But remember that there was always the Sears Roebuck catalog in
it's
the outhouse.
Not as good.
Yeah, that sounds kind
I
of uncomfortable.
Care.
I've heard people say that.
Yes.
I've heard my grandparents say that
yes.
before. But
yes.
Can either you, Catherine, or you, Hannah, school us a little bit about the invention of comfortable toilet paper? When did it become regular in industrialized societies, or at least in U.S. society?
Well, I'm sorry that I don't know the precise history of toilet paper. This is really worth
never
a research
really
project for
no,
sure.
No, I appreciate it. And I know that there have been many times I've even heard things on the radio about, you know, toilet paper. The only thing that's really bad about it, good toilet paper is not made out of recyclable material, so I kind of feel bad about wanting it.
Exactly, but I do have a personal, a family history here on toilet paper, believe it or not.
Oh, please share.
And that is my husband's aunt, her husband's family, owned a paper mill in upstate New York, and they were one of the first manufacturers of perforated, in fact, they were the first manufacturer of perforated toilet paper. So,
and what is,
and this would be in the early 20th century.
So, I'm not even sure I should ask, but I can't help myself. What is perforated toilet paper?
It tears off in sheets. It's
not a
single roll.
Okay, so it wasn't toilet paper that had all little holes in it. All right,
not until they invented the machine to do that process. Yes.
All right, Kathy, you probably heard my question at the top of the hour in relation to this idea that one of the things we're looking at in terms of engineering responsibility is unintended consequences of new technology. So that's why I phrased the question. If there was a particular technology that you could take back with you when you traveled back at least 100 years in time that you knew that you would really miss if you couldn't have it with you, yours is toilet paper. So the other part of the question is, can you see any negative unintended consequences of introducing people, say, in the 19th century or the 18th century to toilet paper?
I'm thinking. Kind of yes, because before, you know, we had indoor plumbing, it probably would have littered up the landscape pretty darn good.
Well, and we, as you just said, it still does. But
Yeah.
It still does. We have not really solved that problem.
You know, I'm thinking, I have to go up into the woods sometimes to work on radio transmitters, and I know that the radio station is going to appreciate this. And so, you know, I have my purse has got, you know, the little necessary papers in it. And I'm having to, like, dig little holes to hide the stuff or throw it back in the woods.
Which takes us into the utopia of the 21st century and what it means to be an engineer, because one of the huge, well, from my point of view, the two huge problems facing engineering and engineers in the 21st century is first, sustainability, and second, globalization. And you mentioned that in your idea of being in England in the 70s and the quality of the toilet paper.
Yeah, I mean, this is certainly an ongoing problem in the developing world. After college, the obligatory 1 year in China that many students are doing these days as we all hunt for jobs, we've got quite a pack of our seniors who are making similar decisions to go abroad. And in much of rural China, even though there's indoor plumbing, you're not ever meant to put toilet paper down through the system. So it's not as if toilet paper is an invention on its own. It's actually part of a system of inventions which kind of carry waste away from our homes and businesses.
And how we use it, and how different cultures use it, and that's again looking at technology from a variety of contexts. I think, Kathy and Hanno, that one of the ways I like to view technology goes back again to a childhood idea and a childhood toy, and that was the kaleidoscope. I had hours of absolute joy playing with my kaleidoscope. And you would turn it just a tiny bit, and the image changes. And you turn it again, and the image changes. But there was still a focal point. And the focal point in terms of utopia, in terms of engineering responsibility, the focal point must be, and one of the misconceptions about engineering is that the focal point is society, every culture, how we are treating various cultures, what does our world look like, how can we make our world better, not just for us, because the problems have no boundaries.
Kathy in Quicksburg, thank you so very much for your call, and it's been personally so reassuring to hear that as much as I fantasize at times about being able to find a time machine and go back in history and visit fascinating historical places, that I'm not the only one who worries about, if I was able to do that, what would I do about having no toilet paper? Our guests on this edition of Virginia Insight, technology and society scholars Hanno Rogers and Catherine Barreto. They are both faculty in a specialized department of the University of Virginia's School of Engineering, that department focusing on history, sociology, and other liberal arts topics that are not always included in the education of future technology creators. Hey, Hanno Rogers, they're just outside the mangrove swamps in Florida. Tell me about this concept of engineering responsibility. What does that mean to you?
Sure. So, there are very typical ways that we tend to think about technology, especially when we talk to students who are going to be designing technologies. They're very hopeful about the way that technology might be able to improve people's lives or change society. The piece that gets missing sometimes, though, is the fact that it's people who do those things. So we talk about this in two ways. One is technological determinism, and this is the bugaboo of our subject. We're worried that people understand incorrectly that technology will define social structures, and that they miss the other piece, which is that social structures are actually defining technology, that technology is made by groups of people.
Okay, so back up for just a moment, if you would, and explain to me what technological determinism means.
Sure, it's very simple. Technology determines social structures. So that technology comes from somewhere, we don't know where, and it has all of these impacts on our society, and we just have to deal with them. We have to make room for the technology. We have to move around for the technology.
So is this like the idea that cars became popular? As a result of cars becoming popular, there was this big push to change how roads were used, and then we ended up with highways, and we ended up with people moving further and further away from center cities, and we ended up with urban sprawl. And all of that was determined by the fact that cars were created.
Absolutely. Or the ideas that people have that we might call utopic that are going on at this moment, that Arab Spring is being made possible through particular technologies, through social media, through the ability to have these tiny, wonderful, movable computers with us, and that will actually lead to a freer society. I think it's not so far from the 19th century examples that Catherine was talking about.
Okay, so that's an explanation of technological determinism, but you say there's an important flip side to that.
That's right. So we talk about the concept of co-production, that people make those technologies, and that therefore people get to make choices about what kinds of technologies that they want, which ones they want to invest in. Congress makes decisions about which National Science Foundation projects are going to be completed, and that where we put our resources, whether the NIH gets more money or the NSF gets more money, that we might have different health outcomes or different new science outcomes. And so that we can't pretend that technology is just coming down to us and that we have to deal with it, but rather that we are making choices about which technologies will be developed.
Catherine Barreto, co-production?
Co-production, another way of another term that we use is mutual shaping of between technology and society.
It sounds like what you and Hanno Rogers are both saying is that we should not feel hopeless in the face of technology. And I got to ask you both to expand on that when we get back from the break. We can hear just a hint of music here indicating the break is only moments away. But I also want to admit that there are lots of times when I'm traveling in my car, especially on one of those highways, and I'm feeling a little bit chagrined by the people around me not paying attention to the highway, texting on their cell phones, and that feels like something I can't do much about. But I'll ask you about that. I'll ask our audience to join in, too, on this topic of engineering responsibility when we get back in just a bit more than 1 minute. From the University of Virginia's School of Engineering, Science, Technology, and Society specialists, Catherine Barreto and Hannah Rogers are our guests. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Ms. Barreto and Dr. Rogers with us to help us delve into this concept of engineering responsibility. And it has a couple of aspects to it, in case you've just joined us. One is, what can we do to encourage future technologies to be socially responsible, for those creating them to give thought ahead of time to what some negative unintended consequences might be and how to plan for those? And then backing up a little bit, just looking at the technologies that are new or fairly new in our world today, how are they being used? How are they affecting us? If you have thoughts or questions on any related topic, we'd love to hear from you at 888-WMRA-TALK. So, Hannah Rogers, talk to me a little bit more about this idea that I should not feel hopeless in the face of technology that seems to be having negative, uncontrolled effects on me when I'm driving down the highway and idiots next to me are paying attention to their cell phones and not the road.
Absolutely. So there was a recent article by a former UVA faculty member, Jamie Wetmore, which was about the Amish. And his suggestion in the Slate article was, we're all becoming more like the Amish. In other words, though we often think that people in Amish communities reject wholesale technologies, actually, they have meetings and decide as a group which technologies would be beneficial to the religious and community formation. And they make decisions about specific technologies and which ones should be allowed. And a similar thing might be going on there, where we start to ask our friends when we're dining, hey, would you turn off your cell phone? Or we understand there are certain contexts in which having the phone on is just not appropriate, like family dinner or maybe driving.
Well, and of course, we have just legislated in Virginia this last month that texting while driving is against the law.
That's the ultimate referendum on our community standard.
That's right. It certainly is.
And you take that as an indication that we as a society are deciding not to use a certain type of potentially dangerous technology, or at least a dangerous use of a new technology, that there's societal pushback against it?
Yes, that we are, and we can't change what is there right now, but we can legislate the way it is used. And that is gives us a sense of control over the technology, so we don't get into that trap of technological determinism, feeling I am being run by whatever, that I can't see the faceless, nameless thing. And I think it's interesting, too, that we have reduced the word technology to a pronoun. We refer to it as it. And when we're talking about it, we need to say much, much more than it. What is it? That is one of the responsibilities that we as society have to ask those questions. But we also have to teach our engineers how to ask those questions.
Hannah Rogers, you were about to jump in. Please do.
I was going to suggest that there are a couple of different levels at which these interventions can be made to make you feel like there's not going to be a problem with people texting beside you. One, we already talked about the kind of community notion that your friends make you feel pressure, that when you're driving you don't text because that's dangerous for them. Another is this legal aspect, that there would be rules, that there are real consequences in the general community. You will be pulled over, you will be arrested if you persist in this behavior. The other is that we can imagine, and often this is the last thing that happens, is there will actually be a material change to the technology which makes it possible. So we come up with new kinds of headsets which allow us to auto-text. We have, you know, airplane mode for our telephones. There are a lot of different things we could do that are actually material changes which encode those decisions we've made as a society that it doesn't make sense for you to text when you drive.
Our guests on this edition of Virginia Insight, technology and society scholars Hannah Rogers and Catherine Barreto. Our overarching topic, engineering responsibility. Our phone number, 888-WMRA-TALK, in all numbers, that's 888-967-2825. Next to Woodstock, Bo, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment, please.
It kind of parallels what was just mentioned, and that's the unexpected consequences our technologies have on the way we acquire, retain, transfer, and use the knowledge that enables all our actions and decisions.
Give me an example.
For instance, most of us have forgotten, or a lot of us of any age, have forgotten how to spell because technology has taken over that job for us. And it may not spell it the way we learned.
Correct.
And there's a lot of things where the technology almost starts to create the policies because it controls the way knowledge is flowing to an organization or individually. For instance, the way television has controlled what we understand is going on in the world has changed the way we seek knowledge.
Hey, Hannah Rogers.
Yes.
You're a bit younger than Catherine Beriteau, or than I am, frankly. So I'm curious, in light of what we're hearing from Bo, one of the things that's been written about recently is the effect of Internet search engines on people's memories. Specifically, of course, Google, and the fact that rather than what people were doing 100 or more years ago, and that was retaining sometimes encyclopedias worth of knowledge, that people who were growing up in the 90s and the 2000s, as you were, are more likely to feel like they don't have to remember a whole bunch of stuff because they can just Google it. Do you see that as related to what Bo is talking about?
Well, unfortunately, because of the way that the system works, I wasn't actually able to hear Bo's question, but there are a lot of SPS scholars who are interested in thinking about this. One of them is Catherine Hales, who's at Duke, and she's interested in the way that that might relate to the different ways we might write, so that writing practice is actually changed by your sense that, oh, people can just look it up. I can talk in kind of general terms. You can find the examples, and that it's changing linguistic structures as well as the interesting questions about reading, that what are people reading differently and what kinds of things do they look for in reading material?
Well, you have just pointed out to us a technology flaw, and I am so glad that you did. Our phone system is supposed to work in a way that you can hear people calling in and they can hear you, and we're going to have our technicians do their best to fix that flaw right now. But let me turn for the moment to our other guest, Catherine Beriteau. Do you see things as examples of what Bo is talking about, ways in which
we
both gain and lose?
I see examples all the time, Bo. And let's just take for one example that in my lifetime, and I think in yours too, but the way words have changed, the number of, if we look at our dictionaries, for example, I know they're old-fashioned books, but if we look at a dictionary, the number of words that come into our language every year come primarily from science and technology. But if we look at certain words and how they were created, for example, the word laser, the word scuba, the word radar, all of those were acronyms for bigger things. They are now listed as common nouns in dictionaries. The second part of your question in terms of how we are being tied, if you will, to certain technologies, I think is a very important one because one of the questions that I always love to ask my students is, what was the first thing you did on a computer? And they say, play games. So for them, the computer was a toy. I had to learn how to use a computer when I was in the early 80s when I was at a university in upstate New York teaching engineers. For me, it was a tool, and it was a vicious tool. And it took me a tremendous amount of time and emotional energy to say, all right, I have to embrace this in order to save, to keep my job. And so I think the way we are introduced to our technologies, the way we get to play with them or not to play with them, becomes a critical, critical part of responsibility for us and for engineers. How do we do it? How do we see these things?
Bo, such a great concept you shared with us. Thank you so much for doing that. Before you go away, let me hit you with our top of the hour teaser question. Can you think of a technology that is present in your life today that if you were able to enter a time machine and travel at least 100 years back in time, that you would most miss because it wasn't back then with you?
Today makes it very clear. Air conditioning.
Agreed.
Thank you so very much.
But at the same time, maybe if we hadn't introduced air conditioning along the line, we would have learned how to continue to learn how to deal with nature better.
Thank you so much. Hannah Rogers, there in Florida, spending time out in the mangrove swamps and what I'm guessing is not 68-degree weather with cool breezes. Can you think of unintended consequences of the benefits of air conditioning that people who first foisted it on us might not have thought of?
Well, certainly in the South, the death of the front porch was heralded by the air conditioning, and the kind of social way that we went outside and saw our neighbors on their porches is all but dead. And when I was a little girl, I really enjoyed sleeping on my grandmother's back porch. Mm-hmm. I don't think anyone would dream of doing that now.
Wonderful. Yes.
There's this theory if the talk show host keeps his mouth shut long enough, the guests will talk to each other.
Oh, okay. Well, I think one of the other unintended consequences, of course, are the emissions from our air conditioners, which are affecting, of course, our environment, and that we could, and as Bo suggested, if we didn't have air conditioning, perhaps we would have found different ways of using nature, as we do in Charlottesville, for example. The Jeffersonian ideal of the forested city to keep it cool.
Okay, I'm going to repeat myself here, but I have not yet found a technology that prevents me from doing this. From nuclear power to plastic bags, how has a past century of new technologies improved our lives? When have they brought us unintended consequences that you there on the other side of your radio would say would be called anything but improvement? We're looking for your thoughts, perspectives, insights, and questions on this very broad, thought-provoking topic today. And we have phone lines now open at 888-WMRA-TALK in all numbers. That's 888-967-2825. Or if you prefer to type instead of the talk, you can reach us on our Facebook page where we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. I don't want to seem like I'm especially poop-centric, but there were so many thoughts I was having back when Kathy called earlier and talking about how much she would miss toilet paper if she had to go back in time or to a place where that modern invention was not available. It does seem to me that there are all kinds of different inventions over the past few decades that have been very focused on getting rid of waste, whether it's bodily waste or garbage. Is that a big area, in your view, Catherine Barreto, where we have not given a lot of thought to unintended consequences, like the convenience of nice throwaway diapers that end up saving and preserving poop for generations to come?
Yes, exactly. And this is one of the issues of engineering responsibility and design that all of us are concerned about, and that is there is the design process, and there are steps in the design process. And one of the major tenets that is coming into the design process is what happens when this design dies or fails or doesn't work? How do we dispose of it? What do we do with it? If your computer on your desk, which is made of what? Plastic, which is a petroleum product. What happens when that computer dies? Where does it go, Tom?
Well, I have enough trouble with the crying and the fits that I'm having when my computer's dying regularly. But I guess part of what you're saying is it probably has toxins in it that leach into bad places.
Exactly. And we, for example, export them to other countries as industrial waste. They then take them apart, and our entire environment is changed by melting of copper, the melting down of lead, And so it's not just our garbage, but ways of designing products and ways of designing, putting that idea that when we design something, we have to look at how to dispose of it. And that's an exciting field of interest.
Hannah Rogers, I don't think this next question is related to poop, although it could be. I have been told that a large part of your mission in life is to get future technologists thinking about art. Tell me about the intersection between art and science and technology.
That's exactly right. I'm really interested in the ways that artists are engaging technologies, since they're taught more regularly to engage critically with what a technology can be. So we spend a lot of time teaching design principles to engineers, and we teach them a lot about materials, how the materials themselves work. And we teach artists about materials, too, but we're frequently asking them to ask the kinds of questions Catherine was just proposing, what happens at the projected end of life for a technology. And so it seems to me that if we can get engineers and artists talking to one another, maybe we can get an exchange going on around this. And if I might relate this back to the ethics course that I teach, there is a film called Dive, which is about food waste. So we also have these moments of planned waste where we never actually plan to use something at all. We have tail ends at all of the supermarkets. We have tail ends at all of the restaurants. And this film is about people dumpster diving for food. And that's the hook that gets the student kind of interested in it. But the real point is, is there something going on in the way our food system is set up that's causing this, or is this a social problem? And initially, many engineering students felt, oh, you know, this must be a social problem. Maybe if we redistribute the food in a certain way, we can fix it. But this film is suggesting that actually there are ways that our food system is structured that promote waste and even guarantee that there is going to be food waste.
And there's a connection in your mind to that and the concept of art?
Sure. So the people who made this film are artists. They're filmmakers, and they don't really know how to fix a food system, but hopefully some of our students do know that. So we can get a conversation going between documentarians and artists, and then our engineers who are really going to impact how these food systems are set up. I think there's a lot of hope.
And read Thomas More's Utopia. He, for example, in Utopia, everyone is recycled, no pun intended, from their jobs in the cities out to the farm every 5 years, where they spend a year producing food for the entire community. Now, that idea of the community garden, the idea of bringing new practices, best practices, of producing a variety of foods, of experimenting with methods of tilling or planting or whatever, we still see today. And rooftop gardens, green roofs, all an example.
Catherine Berto, I understand, back to this concept that you teach about of new technologies and utopia, that there was a time, I think it was a World's Fair, a bit more than 100 years ago, where people were thrilled with this new technology where they actually found beer in cans.
Correct.
But there was something else even bigger that happened at this World's Fair that I want to ask you about. I also want to tell Les in Harrisonburg that he's going to be our next call when we return to this discussion about engineering responsibility in just a bit more than 1 minute. Science, Technology, and Society specialists Catherine Berto and Hannah Rogers are our guests. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. We've got a couple lines open if you want to join the conversation at 888-WMRA-TALK. If you've just joined us, essentially what we're looking at is the degree to which new technologies have affected our lives in wonderful ways that we may take for granted today, and also how some of those wonderful things may have unintended consequences that are a bit negative. And if you buy into those ideas, then what kind of responsibility to the inventors of future technologies have to think about ahead of time in terms of unintended consequences? What do we want them to try to mitigate? Our phone number and all numbers, 888-967-2825. Now, Les in Harrisonburg, thanks for joining in. Your question or comment, please.
All right. Thank you. A moment ago, you were talking about engineering responsibility. And that's kind of the whole premise of the show. That implies that unintended consequences are due to engineering irresponsibility. And I guess I'd have to take issue with that, particularly because of engineering ethics that one of the speakers was talking about a few moments ago. In my experience as an engineer for over 50 years, has been that most of the unintended consequences are a result of human fallibility.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the speakers was, while I was waiting on the line, was talking a bit about teaching students to ask the appropriate questions. And I'd like them to expand upon that and also talk about human fallibility and how one can guard against that.
Well, I think one of the things about asking questions and teaching ethics, and that ethics is all about asking questions. And one point, you as an engineer know this better than I do or better than Hannah does, but to my knowledge, there are only 2 4-year degrees which, when you receive your diploma, you are considered a professional. Those two professional fields are nursing and engineering. Now, as a member of society, we all have had experiences, human experiences, one-on-one experiences with a nurse. We know how they behave, what they do, how they do it, and we feel good about it. The engineer, in so many ways, is the faceless thing. And as you well know, engineers work in groups. We can't blame one engineer for a particular failure of a design or a particular failure of the way we are using a particular product. And so what do? We say, oh, if I could only talk to that person, I would. And yet it's not one single person. And so many of the unintended consequences come from not the way the engineer's design has been laid out, but the way we have used the design, modify the design for our own pleasure or profit or whatever. And Hannah, can you hear this question?
I can.
Were you able to hear less, Hannah?
I was.
Oh, good.
So, yeah, I'm quite interested in this problem because the students frequently ask me this. Well, look, Dr. Rogers, when I go out and design something, how am I going to be able to guess all the possible users? And, of course, we're not expecting that our students are going to have a crystal ball, that they'll know what all the affordances, that is to say, all the potential things the technology could do would be. But to pretend that just because we can't know everything, we're going to know nothing, doesn't really work. I mean, we teach students a lot about risk. What are the things that are high risk? And I think one of the best ways we can take a guess at what a new technology might look like is to look at the history of all of these old technologies. What happened last time when we did this? Now, of course, something different might happen this time, but the same thing might happen again. And I think it's really worth considering that. And we certainly don't want to suggest that the entire burden falls on the certainly not an individual engineer, but even an individual firm, because you're in a competitive marketplace. There are a lot of switchbacks that aren't just about design going on, but there are still questions that we can raise and ask. And I think asking them around specific case studies is probably the best way to do that. I'm really interested in technologies that have accidentally, specifically marginalized a certain group of people. For example, we know that much of the voice recognition software, and I'm speaking here of the first-generation software, late 80s, early 90s, was much better for men. Women's voices were not recognized very well in it. It didn't pick them up well. Now, did some engineers sit down and say, hey, look, I only want to sell this to half the population? No way. They immediately understood that actually secretaries were going to be major users of this, and we know that many secretaries are women. In fact, continuing the majority of professional secretaries are women. So it wasn't that it was designed to do that, but the testing phases let them know that there was a problem here. So teaching students that in testing you have an opportunity to fix some of these potentially ethically questionable problems, that's something we should be pointing out to our students.
Again, the idea...
I have this question in my head that looks complicated there, but I'm hoping that as I try to speak it, I can simplify it. It gets back to something we talked about earlier with cell phones and texting, and I just want to ask for your impression about this. A few years ago, when people at Apple and the other companies that knew they were coming out with so-called smartphones, where texting was going to become much, much more common than it already was on cell phones, do you think, Les, that they should have been able to predict that that would lead to an even bigger problem with people texting while they're driving and being distracted and causing more accidents? Or is it possible that even if they could have predicted that, they would say, that's somebody else's problem. Our job is to make a profit and sell as many units as we can?
I think foreseeing that people would try to text and drive was possible, certainly. I mean,
and do you think a company or a group of inventors who can see something obvious like that coming up have a responsibility to try to mitigate that? Or is that really, from your perspective, not something they should worry about?
No, I think that they might. I don't know whether they thought about it. You know, that's the thing. But certainly that in trying to look at, okay, say, well, this is the problem. People would text and drive. Is there any technology that we could put into this phone that would prevent that? And I think that is an essence of engineering responsibility.
Les, thank you so very much for sharing your perspective with us. Science, technology, and society specialists Catherine Barreto and Hannah Rogers are guests on this edition of Virginia Insight. If you want to talk to them, we've got a few more minutes to take calls and still a couple of lines open at 888-WMRA. Talk next to Shenandoah Lee. Thanks for joining in. Your question or comment, please.
Thank you for taking my call. I hate to go back to the old school toilet paper where we started from here.
We all need it.
what I'd like to reference here is the one of the triumphs of the Victorian age was putting indoor plumbing in London and got rid of, I don't know, typhoid, plague, whatever it was. It totally made cities functional, but it put effluent into the North Sea or wherever they dumped it. And now we've got, I think, like 7 spots in the middle of the oceans that are basically dead seas. So it was great technology for humanity moving to cities. On the other hand, it was not so good for the oceans that we need to survive as well.
Hannah?
That certainly seems correct. Interested also in water systems more generally and the ways that we've been willing to sacrifice rural communities to bring big quantities of fresh water into cities. This is certainly going in upstate New York. It's going on in the water dispute between Alabama and Georgia because of the needs of Atlanta. And so, again, this has to do with which people were willing to sacrifice. Is it okay to mess up portions of the ocean that we may need to someday fish in, or do we think that's too much of a cost? And weighing those risks are something that we have to ask engineers to be interested in, even if they mostly like to work on technologies. Figuring out what those potential other problems are, as our earlier guest was saying, is just fundamental to the design process.
Well, I think two things, and I want to go back to something you said earlier, Hannah, and that is the history of the technology. That, and I'm going to specifically reference two things. First of all, Melvin Kranzberg, who was one of the founding fathers of the Society of History of Technology back in 1957, in a speech in 1987, it was the after-dinner speech at a conference, and what is euphemistically now called Kranzberg's Six Laws. But in the first one said that technology is neither good nor bad, it's neutral. But later on, he says something which is so important for the understanding what are engineering responsibilities. And it is his fourth law. All history is relevant, but the history of technology is the most relevant. And that means for an engineer to look at a problem not just as it is happening, but look at the history of the problem. Because I guarantee, and we all guarantee, the problem has been around for a long time. So looking at how many people have tried to solve this problem, why did their solutions, why weren't their solutions used? Were there better solutions? And this takes us back to the second idea that Eugene Ferguson in The Making of an Engineer, which is I recommend highly, but one of his positions, which I remind my students of all the time, and this is a direct quote, engineers need to be continually reminded that nearly all engineering failures result from faulty judgments rather than faulty calculations, which takes us right back to we're all human beings.
Lee in Shenandoah, thank you so very much for getting us thinking both about unintended consequences and trade-offs. Was one improvement worth the later difficulty? That applies to so much of what we're talking about today. I sure do appreciate your call. We're going to run out of time here, and before we do, Catherine Baratoa, I have to ask you about something that I'm given to understand affects a lot of your thinking about the work that you do today. The fact that you grew up in an era, in a place that, from your view, because of certain types of technologies, was a kind of utopia. Tell us about that.
I grew up in upstate New York and in dairy country. There was virtually no industry, and there were four universities in a 12-mile radius. And there was not what people have called the separation of town and gown. You'd had to depend upon your plumber if your pipes froze in the middle of the winter. You knew where your milk came from. You knew the name of your local dairy. Every small town had its own cheddar cheese factory, and they competed, and you knew, well, this cheese is from town A, this is from town B. You could tell by the taste. The sense of knowing where things came from, who was doing the work, built a tremendous sense of community and trust. And yes, I don't think I'm idealizing it when I say it was utopic. And yes, Hannah, we had a beautiful front porch, and people walked past in summer evenings, and we talked.
Now, we're not going to give away anything about your age, I don't think, but it's fair to say that you were a child in this idyllic setting in the 1960s, 1970s.
Yes, correct.
And your view, in part, was the kind of farming success that was possible in these rural towns was because of technological advancements over the past 50 or 60 years before then?
Not really, because they, for example, many of the areas of the farms were not completely electrified. There was, in some areas, they were still hand milking the cows.
So the use of tractors and fertilizers make a big difference in your mind?
Yes, it did. They were there. But that was not the image. It was the image of the feeling of working with a variety of people, understanding what they did, and seeing them work.
And if we were to go back there some 50 years later, is it your sense that there were technological changes that led to a change that is no longer as utopic?
Yes, and that was the big agribusiness buying out the local farms. But to go back to a point Hannah was talking about and referencing Jamie Wetmore and the Amish, there are many Amish people who have moved to upstate New York and are crafting the homemade cheeses. And they have chosen as a community to use cell phones in order to check what time the milk truck is coming to pick up their milk, because they do not have electricity on their farms, and they can't put the farm, they don't have coolers or heated boxes to put the milk containers in. And so they have to know exactly what time the milk truck is coming so they can deliver the cans to the milk truck.
Hannah Rogers, that takes us back for a final few moments. We've only got about 30 seconds left to this idea that you rose earlier about co-production and a sense of hopefulness about future technology, because you think if people are making decisions about technology as a group, as a society, that things will get better?
Well, we certainly have talked about the ways in which we can say no to technologies, that we can decide to turn off our cell phone. Whole groups of people may make decisions like that. You know, a lot of us have made a choice, like, you know, my son or daughter is not going to use a cell phone until they're a certain age. But I think it's important to remember not only that we have the choice to say yes or no to each technology, but there are a lot of degrees and possibilities for our own designing inside of it. At Thanksgiving, we might reconfigure the dinner tables. It doesn't mean that we've actually changed the dinner tables, but in a sense, we're designers because we get to decide how to configure different technologies we already possess to do the things that we need for them to do.
Our guests have been Catherine Barrateau and Hannah Rogers, both faculty members in the Department of Science, Technology, and Society in the School of Engineering at the University of Virginia. Catherine, Hannah, you certainly have gotten us thinking. Thank you so very much for making time for us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Virginia Insight's executive producer, Matt Bingay. Our associate producers, Terry Ward and Bob Levicky. Some of our break music supplied by Robert Juspe and Inner Rhythm. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.